I'm Ed Howard with the Alliance for Health Reform. I want to welcome you to this briefing on behalf of Senator Jay Rockefeller, our honorary chairman, Senator Susan Collins, our honorary vice chairman, co-chairman, and our board of directors, to this briefing on how best to get more value for our very large investment in health care spending in this country. The tool we're looking at today for doing that is called comparative effectiveness analysis. Doesn't exactly trip off the tongue, but it's a term with a lot of promise to help improve the uneven performance of our healthcare system. Today, when the Food and Drug Administration okays a new drug, it in effect certifies that the new drug is better than nothing. Even if it isn't as effective as something that's already on the market and costs 10 times as much, it's better than nothing. And generally, that policy applies not just to drugs, but to other clinical interventions and equipment as well. It's comparative effectiveness analysis that attempts to get us beyond that point. Our partner in today's briefing is the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. It's America's largest philanthropy devoted to health and health care, and it's a leader in pursuing comparative effectiveness work, which, when you think about it, isn't very surprising given that the foundation CEO, Dr. Risa Lavizzo-More, is in fact herself one of the country's most respected health researchers. If comparative effectiveness is ripe with promise, it's also fraught with concerns. And a lot of them have to do with the appropriate role of government in this activity. What kind of entity ought to be doing this research or commissioning it? Who ought to set the agenda? Who ought to pay the price? What ought the price tag be? How should the results be used? That is, more specifically, should it be tied and how closely to payment policy? So there's an awful lot for us to discuss today. Let me make my usual logistical observations. You'll be able to see a webcast of this session as of Tuesday morning and maybe sooner on kaisernetwork.org. You'll also be able to see a transcript a few days after that. There will be copies of the materials in your packets available on the Kaiser Network website and on the alliances. In fact, those are already there. That's allhealth.org. And those of you who can do podcasts, you can podcast this one in a few days. You're going to have a chance to ask a lot of questions. There are green question cards in your packets for that purpose. There are microphones both in front and in back for you to ask them orally. So be prepared to be an active participant in this discussion. Let me turn now to our panel. Let me first ask you to turn your pagers and your telephones to vibrate or off or whatever you need to do. We don't want to hear whatever it was that new ring you downloaded last week is. We want to hear from our speakers, who are in fact an extremely capable and distinguished lot today. There is more information than I have time to give to you about them in your materials. And we're going to start with Dr. Carolyn Clancy, who's entering her sixth year as director of the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, ARC. Dr. Clancy has a distinguished career that includes a number of prestigious academic and research positions. Her agency not only conducts and funds a whole range of quality-related research, but was given explicit authority and a little bit of money in the Medicare Modernization Act to conduct comparative effectiveness analysis. I want to say, by the way, Carolyn joins us even though her advisory council is meeting today, so we're going to change the usual protocol a little bit. After her remarks, we'll take a few questions specifically directed for her, if you have them, before she has to leave us, and then we'll hear from our other panelists. Carolyn, thanks for making time in a very busy day to join us today.
This one. That sounds better, yes. Thank you very much, Ed, and good afternoon, everyone. And I'm really thrilled to be here with my other three colleagues. And normally I don't approve of this prima donna, sort of I have to come and run, but today my advisory council is in town, which in this instance means Rockville. So I'm very pleased to have an opportunity to tell you about the work that we've been doing in comparative effectiveness research. Our authority derives from the Medicare Modernization Act, as you said, and the specific language directs us to improve the quality, effectiveness, and efficiency of health care delivered through Medicare, Medicaid, and SCHIP. So our focus is on what's known now, ensuring that programs benefit from past investments in research. Many of you have probably heard that it often takes us quite a long time to translate findings from research into practice, and to identify what research gaps are critical to fill. Our focus is explicitly on clinical effectiveness, not on cost effectiveness. So the key program attributes that we have strived in, our funding started in fiscal year 2005. First, to make sure that we're building an infrastructure not only to conduct the work, but also an infrastructure that will support the rapid uptake and use of this information so that clinicians and patients can have good information when they're making very important decisions. This obviously builds on our connections and partnerships with providers, consumers, health plans, and so forth. If there's one thing that we want the work to be, it has to be unbiased, and it has to be responsive to the needs of those who are receiving care, delivering it, leading healthcare organizations, and paying for it. To that end, we have a group of stakeholders who have been invaluable to us as we have launched and continually refined this program. And we know that the work has to be trusted, or it won't be credible. And to that end, we do a great deal, including a very strong focus on transparency. So we actively seek input on setting priorities for this work. We seek specific public input from nomination for topics for research, comments on how specific questions are framed, as well as comments on draft reports. In fact, some of these reports are actually covered by electronic newsletters and so forth. And we think that is great, because if everyone can see it and understand the work, then there will not be a black box. People won't feel like someone had a database and did something and magically came out with an answer that doesn't make sense at all. Because if they do feel that way, then the work won't be perceived as credible. Now, we've been fortunate that we could actually build off and leverage our existing research infrastructure. So the evidence-based practice centers are located across North America, and we turn to them to synthesize existing research. And any time we do that, we, of course, are doing a very active search to see if the Cochrane Collaboration or other well-known and prestigious groups have already done something similar, because we don't want to waste a single federal dollar if someone else has already done a similar sort of research that we can build on. In addition to that, the Centers for Education and Research and Therapeutics have been up and running for about 9 years. The two new components are the DECIDE Network, which is a network of research contractors, including the University of Chicago, the HMO Research Network, about 13 different partners who have access to substantial databases with clinical electronic information, and they help us close some of the research gaps. And the Eisenberg Center is a new center named for our former director at the University of Oregon that helps us develop important prototypes for a variety of audiences. So the program outputs, metaphorically here, the research reports are really, really long, probably a terrific cure for insomnia, but they're extremely explicit in every single step of the process. So the people, we take transparency very, very seriously here. The systematic reviews, this short guide for clinicians is what's labeled systematic review. And then we have consumer guides. Now, how you present the same information to consumers and to clinicians is quite different. And for many products, what we're talking about is actually helping individuals assess and balance for themselves the balance of benefits and potential harms or side effects. Getting this right for people with varying degrees of health literacy is an important challenge. I should have said at the outset two important things. Number one, our priorities are set by condition, because the issue isn't is drug A better than drug B or device C better than device D, but what makes the most sense given this particular clinical condition. That's the kind of decision that clinicians and patients have to make all the time. The second is that any time a manufacturer is potentially affected by our review, they are notified at the very outset. If they've got additional data or information we can take advantage of, we are thrilled to do that. So just to give you a sense, we're very, very excited that Medscape now uses this as the basis for continuing education for clinicians. We're also excited that the Consumers Union uses it in many of their reports, the National Business Group on Health. And most of these reports have been published at the same time that we posted online in the Annals of Internal Medicine, which right after the New England Journal in JAMA is, I think, one of the most widely distributed clinical journals. So at a very high level, what have we learned? Well, I think there's been some concern that, you know, the ultimate outcome could be perceived by someone as a giant thumbs up or a giant thumbs down on a particular service. And in fact, we find that that's rarely the case. In fact, we think the reports actually help refine and will help clinicians and healthcare organizations refine the process of identifying more rapidly which patients are most likely to benefit from particular services so that access to effective treatments is actually maximized. We also are humbled or amazed by how much we don't know about common and ubiquitous treatments, and we've understood that we need to anticipate questions that decision makers will be asking years in advance. Now, this year, 2008, we are really excited that our investment doubles from $15 million to $30 million. That means that the number of comparative effectiveness reviews and technical briefs will double. A new series of technical reports will establish a foundation to guide the evaluation of gene-based diagnostic test performance, and the number of products designed to help patients and clinicians make informed decisions will increase. In addition to that, we're making some key investments to begin to expand the capacity to do this kind of work. We need to be thinking right now, how do we recruit the best and the brightest to make careers in this kind of work? Because as a result of biomedical innovation, there's a tremendous need for this kind of work. Now, I'm showing you here a picture of a journal called Medical Care, which many of you may not be familiar with. But it's a journal that's very, very well known for its methodological rigor. And we take the issue of continuing to improve and innovate in the methods used to do this work very, very seriously. The reason for that is we are approaching a time when data are going to be ubiquitous. That's because of investments and multiple levels of interest in the use of health IT to improve care. But at the same time, that means that we have to be very, very confident that studies done, observational or quasi-experimental studies done using these data, are rigorous and robust and that we can trust the results. So we have continued to emphasize throughout the program the need to keep innovating in methods. So this is just a picture of one of the journal supplements that post that, and these are available free of charge. And these, too, were reviewed by a very, very broad audience. Now, the big question I think that many of us are contemplating is, so how do we get from high-quality research to high-value in healthcare? Ed introduced this discussion by saying that this is now seen as an answer. And so what I'm going to give you is a sense of how we're thinking about this issue. What's clear is that we need to be thinking now about how the information from the work we're supporting is actually made ready to use and easy to use by clinicians and patients in real time. So that means that we're increasingly talking with product developers, those who develop electronic health records, and as a way of figuring out how can they embed the findings from this work in clinical decision support and so forth. To that end, I think we're very blessed to be able to work with the Office of the National Coordinator as well as the resources we've gotten from the Congress to support evaluation and promotion of health IT to improve safety and quality. Now, the second bullet here speaks to distributed leadership, and what I mean by that is there has to be a very clear alignment, and we use a variety of strategies to promote this alignment between the needs of those who are paying for healthcare, leading healthcare organizations, and so forth, and the priorities for the work that we're supporting. Clearly, within HHS, we have a lot of opportunities to make sure that the work that we're supporting is aligned with the priorities for Medicare, Medicaid, and SCHIP, but it's equally important for the private sector. Ultimately, we see that there's a terrific opportunity for this work to provide important feedback to much earlier phases of biomedical research. In other words, that the delivery system itself becomes a platform for discovery. There's a lot of excitement right now about the use of patient registries. For us, it's a key part of what the work that CMS is doing for coverage with evidence development. It's of enormous interest to many clinician professional organizations as they strive to come up with strategies to improve the care that they're providing. And we see that we're going to be taking great advantage of that as well. It's also a very, very important strategy to identify particular needs of relatively unusual conditions or relatively unusual treatments. So to that end, about a year and a half ago, we published an online guide to developing patient registries, which benefited from input from people across the country. So let me just close by saying, I think that this is a very important opportunity for us. I want to thank those of you in the Congress who had anything to do with this and say that we think that it's incredibly important that transparency in both the production and the use of this information is going to be critical to make sure that this work actually helps us get to high-value health care. So with that, I will thank you for your attention and would be happy to take any questions.
Great. Thank you, Carolyn. I think we will preclude the use of written questions at this stage. If you have a question for Dr. Clancy, I would urge you to come to one of the microphones. Let me start off, if I can, while we're waiting for that to happen, Carolyn, and just ask if this may be a little too early, but can you identify one or two of the findings from your work in this area that have been of most interest to clinicians or the other folks most interested in them?
Well, let me just give you one from the very first report that we published, which was on gastroesophageal reflux disease, known to clinicians as GERD, and to the rest of the world as heartburn. This turns out to be, not surprisingly for anyone who's ever watched TV, even if it's educational programming, a very, very important problem for the Medicare population. A lot of resources used, a lot of discomfort, time off, and problems caused by this issue. There are basically two lines of treatment. One is two types of drugs, two classes of medications, and the other is surgery. And what our report found was that one class of drugs was clearly superior to the other. And we found that the mainstream or classic surgical techniques and the superior class of drugs were roughly equivalent. We were very clear to point out that there were newer surgical techniques coming online in the form of laparoscopic techniques and said that we simply didn't have enough information to synthesize, so we weren't going to make it up or guess or make a judgment, but said that updates of this report would focus on newer techniques. And we also made it clear to people that if you went in and had a classic or traditional surgical procedure and thought that you could throw your pills away, that you might be actually misguided. About two-thirds of people end up needing to take some medication, not as much as before surgery. So what we're giving people is the facts and saying, here it is in a way that you can understand it, and you and your clinician need to make a decision.
Yes, if you would identify yourself and state your question.
I'm Kristen Bass with the Senate Finance Committee. Query, Carolyn, you talk about transparency being very important, which we would agree with, of course. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the steps that you take within HRQ to make sure that your methodology and other and the research you're doing is transparent. I wouldn't mind having David Nexon comment on whether he thinks that's adequate.
Sure. And let me just start off by saying I have no idea if David will be positive or negative, but we welcome feedback and suggestions in terms of how we can improve that. So if you think about this setting, starting with setting priorities, we have benefited enormously from feedback both from the public programs, obviously CMS programs, and also from the private sector. We've had a number of listening sessions, and we have an ongoing way to collect that information on our website. But priorities, you know, 10 or 12 conditions where we focused our work for the first couple of years are very, very high level. Beyond that, we're also looking for feedback on specific topics and specific questions. One of the challenges clinicians face is actually trying to take clinical research and in some way translate it to the patient and the specific question in front of them. There's often a big gap there. So to that end, we want a lot of input on how those questions are framed. The work is then commissioned to one of our evidence-based practice centers or one of the DECIDE networks, and then the draft report is put out for public comment. Any of you who are interested in these details, the website is effectivehealthcare, all one word, .ahrq.gov, and you can sign up to get notifications of when topics are updated and when there are other opportunities to comment and so forth. And as I noted earlier, these draft reports are often reported on in newsletters and so forth. Now, we solicit explicit review as well, particularly on the statistical side, because many of these methods that are using very large databases actually do raise very important statistical questions. So we want to make sure that we have the best people reviewing that. And sometimes in response to comments that people submit to us, we then go out and get more reviews. So that's a high-level view of how it works.
Can I just ask a quick follow-up question and then have David go? I guess my question was more focused on the methodology at the time the research is being undertaken.
Sure.
Because some of the criticism that we've heard is that being able to comment after the fact doesn't necessarily help as much, potentially, as being able to comment on the methodology ahead of time so that the research that's done is done in a way that is methodologically better or more correct or whatever. Now, we've also heard concerns that when you then, especially with you guys, when you then sub it out, that a lot of times people have good comment, maybe transparency at your level, but the subs don't necessarily. So if you could just, and then I'll shut up.
Yeah, thanks. No, well, if you think about that, we've got 13 partners in the DECIDE network, and I think either 12 or 13 evidence-based practice centers. I'm probably embarrassing a colleague not knowing the precise number here. To some extent, making sure that their work is consistent and that there's some synergy and consistency across all those partners is very important. So we actually have a coordinating center that helps us do this. The coordinating center also is the group that helps us identify where other centers have done similar work and so forth. So to some extent, framing the questions we have identified as the most important part of this, because we've got this coordinating center and we're often looking back and using the public comment as a way to improve our processes, we think that's a good way. If people have alternative suggestions, we're all ears in terms of how we might do a better job doing this. I will say that some people have asked, can the public comments be public? And we're actually exploring how we might do that. NICE does this in the UK. I think they do it after a certain time period, and we're trying to figure out the feasibility of doing that. But again, we think that the more people can actually see what's happening. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question exactly, but maybe David can help.
David?
Probably not. I just say in general, I think we've been very pleased.
You want it? Yeah. And lean in pretty close.
Okay. In general, we've been very pleased with the functioning of ARC under Carolyn's leadership. We think the quality of the work is good, and there's certainly been an openness to discussing issues with industry. So we're very pleased with that. In terms of whether the formal processes are those that we think are the right ones, I'd really have to defer to other people within our organization. I'd be happy to get you back some more specific information, Kristen.
Thanks.
Your last chance to ask a question.
Hi, my name's Karen Sanders. I'm with the American Psychiatric Association, and we actually try to comment on some of the drug reviews, but one of the biggest problems we have is the short window of time. There's 300-page drug review, and you have 2 weeks to do that, so it really becomes difficult for an organization like ourselves to be able to take it seriously. So I wonder if you could comment on that.
My only comment would be to say I'm really glad to hear it, and I will take that back. I think on occasion people have asked us if they could have more time, and we've been responsive to that. I've had personal friends basically say, I have to tell you, I don't even have an industrial printer to print off a very long report. And I am very, very sympathetic to that, so I want to thank you for bringing it up, and we'll continue to be on the alert for that.
Carolyn, let me just ask one question that illustrates how ill-informed I am on this. Is the activity that you've described all represents synthesis of existing information as opposed to new research? Is that a correct assumption?
No, it's both synthesis of existing information. And I will say, quite apart from today's discussion, there are scientists who believe that every clinical trial ever done or major clinical study ought to be preceded by a systematic review so that we take advantage of work that's been done in the past. You may recall some of you seeing an article in the Post a couple of years ago that made the case that some researchers had looked back and realized that we knew enough about the importance of sleeping on your back, having infants sleep on their backs to prevent sudden infant death syndrome back in the 70s. The Back to Sleep campaign was ultimately motivated by much more recent studies, but the fact that we had failed to look back was an important opportunity missed. So, yes, synthesis is a big part of it, but we also use this DECIDE network in order to address and close research gaps.
Good. Our panelists want to engage Dr. Clancy before we let her escape back to her counsel. Very good. Carolyn, thank you so much for doing this.
I really
appreciate it, and we'll look forward to the further developments.
Thank you very much.
We have three very distinguished panelists with which to conduct the rest of this program. We're going to start with Wilhelmine Miller, who's an associate research professor at George Washington's School of Public Health and Health Services. Before coming to GW, 2006, Professor Miller was a senior program officer at the Institute of Medicine, where she directed a major project to advise federal agencies on the use of cost-effectiveness data to evaluate various federal regulations. She's now a member of the IOM's Committee on Reviewing Evidence to Identify Highly Effective Clinical Services, which does not have a good acronym. But it does have a great report called Knowing What Works in Healthcare. That's in English. I like that. And that appears, we have a couple of short iterations of that report in your materials. That project, by the way, flows from a request and support from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. So we are circular in this activity in that regard. Wilhelmine, thank you for being with us to talk about some of the work of the IOM and its related activity.
Thank you, Ed. I'm pleased to present the recommendations of the IOM committee that produced Knowing What Works in Healthcare. I won't repeat our excruciatingly long title. The 16-member committee worked over an 18-month period under the leadership of Barbara McNeil, chair of the Department of Health Policy at Harvard University Medical School, and Hal Sox, editor of the Annals of Internal Medicine at the American College of Physicians. Jill Eden was the study director at IOM, and she and her staff made this report possible and of the quality it is in all respects. So I want to be sure to thank her. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation commissioned this report in recognition that American healthcare and medical practice suffer from a lack of solid, credible, and readily usable information about the effectiveness of many healthcare services, technologies, and treatment patterns. The foundation charged the committee to recommend an approach to identifying highly effective clinical services, a process to evaluate evidence about clinical effectiveness, and an organizational framework for using evidence reports to make recommendations. The charge to the committee was limited in the following respects. First, considerations of cost, specifically the use of cost-effectiveness analysis, was tabled by the foundation, which stated its intention to delve into this area subsequent to the conduct of the IOM committee's work. Second, the organizational locus of any new program that the committee might propose was set aside as not necessary for the committee itself to consider. And finally, the committee was not asked to recommend specific funding levels for either the individual studies that would inform clinical effectiveness research or the program that it might ultimately devise. So this schematic sets out the order of development and the relationship between individual studies that can inform judgments of clinical effectiveness, the highest level box, the body of evidence, which includes everything from randomized clinical trials to observational studies, case reports, information from registries, and studies based on administrative claims data. All of that is the body of evidence. Secondly, come systematic reviews of the body of evidence of effectiveness. And this is when you take all the individual pieces of information, judge their relative strengths, their limitations, the questions they actually answer, and try to get some consistency with that. And then finally, the variety and sources of policies that can make use of systematic reviews of clinical effectiveness information. So these policy applications range from practice guidelines that are addressed to clinicians, patients, and consumers, to performance measures for quality assessment or payment purposes, and to coverage decisions that public and private payers might make. The IOM report recommendations address the activities represented by the last two boxes, approaches to reviewing and synthesizing primary evidence, and the development of policies and specifically practice guidelines that are based on systematic reviews of clinical effectiveness. So what are some of the strengths of our national approach to technology assessment and effectiveness research? First, the actual methods for systematic reviews are quite well developed, thanks, as Dr. Clancy showed us, to investments that ARC has made in methodology development and to the work of other organizations that have gone on over the past 20 to 30 years, such as the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force and international collaborative efforts, such as the Cochrane Collaborations, which is based on parallel work on technology assessment and effectiveness research that is in large part based in Canada and Great Britain, but certainly has extended throughout the world. Secondly, that we do have a network in the U.S. of professionals skilled in systematic reviews. They are engaged at academic centers or by commercial firms that are sponsored by payers to review technology and evaluate clinical research. Our system is pluralistic. It's close to the ground, and as you'll see in the future couple of slides, our system can be quick to address emerging technologies, although maybe not always as consistently or efficiently as we might like. We do have some excellent models for transparent, rigorous guideline development. For example, the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association, the American Academy of Clinical Oncologists. There are all kinds of professional organizations that have been very open, scientific in their approach to developing guidelines. And finally, there are very influential users of guidelines. NCQA, which has developed HEDIS standards based on best practices information, and payers such as Medicare, Medicaid, Blue Cross, Blue Shield. So some of the problems with the status quo, there's extensive duplication of efforts by insurers and private groups, which are often focusing their reviews narrowly on new technologies. And unlike ARC, I would say, to ARC's credit, not so always focused on comparing emerging practices to existing practices. There are potential and real conflicts of interest in assessing evidence and promulgating guidelines. Systematic reviews and guidelines themselves sometimes lack scientific rigor. It's a relatively new discipline, and it's financially undersupported, and so the field itself is working on upgrading its own standards. And finally, it's difficult for users to often see the connections between the evidence generated in the research literature and clinical recommendations. Clinical recommendation and guideline processes are neither systematic nor consistent across sponsors, and they're not transparent. So the next couple of slides reproduce a table from the report that illustrates the duplication of efforts by health plans and technology assessment firms for a sample of 20 screening, diagnostic, disease management, and treatment services over the course of 1 year. And again, you see four health plans here: United Healthcare, Kaiser Permanente, Aetna, WellPoint, which generously shared with the committee some of the information about the specific services that they had their own internal or commissioned technology assessment work done, and three private technology assessment firms: Hayes Incorporated, the Blue Cross Blue Shield Technology Evaluation Center, and ECRI. Of the 20 services sampled across these domains of services, 14 were found to be evaluated by all seven groups in 1 year. 17 were evaluated by five of the seven groups, and ARC evaluated five of them. So this is just to show that a lot of effort is going on, particularly with respect to emerging technologies, to determine what health plans should do in response to the availability of a new kind of service about which not everyone knows a lot. So on to the committee's recommendations. First, the committee recommends that Congress direct the Secretary of Health and Human Services to create a single entity with authority, overarching responsibility, sustained resources, and the adequate capacity to ensure that credible, unbiased information about clinical effectiveness is produced. The program should set priorities for, fund, and manage systematic reviews of clinical effectiveness. It should develop a common language and standards for reporting on, for conducting systematic reviews and reporting on recommendations, provide a forum for addressing conflicting guidelines and recommendations, and make an annual report to Congress. A clinical effectiveness advisory board should oversee this program. The advisory board should be constituted to minimize bias due to conflict of interest and represent diverse public and private sector expertise and interests. In each area of activity, priority setting, evidence assessment, and guidelines development, the program should develop standards to minimize bias due to conflicts of interest. And I think you'll remember from Dr. Clancy's slides the importance of the openness of the priority setting process, the collection of input from all stakeholders, and the like. So we think that in the ARC effective healthcare program, there is a really good model for what a program like this should be doing. So a second advisory group should also be established by the program to set priorities for clinical effectiveness reviews. The priority setting process should be open, transparent, and take nominations for priorities for clinical effectiveness studies from all stakeholders. The priorities, much like the priorities that the ARC effective healthcare program now has promulgated, should reflect the potential for improving health across the lifespan, reduce the burden of disease and health disparities, eliminate undesirable variation in medical practice, and also consider economic factors such as the cost of treatment and the economic burden of the disease addressed when it decides what are its priorities for clinical effectiveness reviews. So one of the most important contributions of a centrally coordinated comparative effectiveness review enterprise is to develop a common language for characterizing the strength of the evidence of effectiveness. Right now, various and influential, scientifically rigorous and influential organizations have their own rating schemes, which detracts from their usability and understandability by clinicians and payers and consumers. Second, the committee recognizes the need to support the development of the analytical capacity in the research workforce to conduct effectiveness reviews. And I would also say that the increase in funding that ARC has experienced recently is certainly going to work to improve this capacity building effort in the research workforce. So, finally, groups that develop clinical guidelines or recommendations, and here the committee did not envision that the federal program or the centrally designed program would develop its own guidelines necessarily, but would essentially certify organizations such as professional groups who do develop guidelines to adhere to the standards set out by the program and be very public in their documentation of their adherence to these standards. So the committee envisions a wide audience and a range of consumers for clinical practice guidelines developed according to the program standards. These can be adopted by clinicians and other providers, public and private insurers, purchasers of healthcare, accrediting organizations for quality review and licensing, performance measurement groups, and patients and consumers. And that concludes my presentation. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Wilhelmine. We turn next to Karen Ignani, who's the president and CEO of America's Health Insurance Plans, AHIP, which is the national trade association for just under 1,300 health insurance organizations. Karen has graced a number of alliance programs before. She has a rich and varied professional background, including service right here on the Senate side, on the staff. Karen's members have to decide in many cases which interventions to cover, which means they have one of the most direct stakes in comparative effectiveness analysis. And not surprisingly, she and AHIP have thought a lot about this issue. We're pleased to have you share some of your thinking with us.
Thank you, Ed. Good afternoon. If I could have the advancer, clicker, that'd be great. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here and to be part of this important panel at a time that all of you are very close, it seems. I don't mean to be presumptuous in saying that, but in advancing something that we think has tremendous possibilities. I was reflecting and listening to Wilhelmine's wonderful presentation and terrific work that the IOM has done, and listening to Carolyn, and it struck me that there are a couple of observations that may contextually be useful as you think about this arena. The first is, I think we contemplate the concept of comparative effectiveness at a time after the IOM first did its report on crossing the quality chasm. And essentially, and I know virtually everyone here has read it, essentially what the IOM said was that the gold standard is right care, right time, right setting. The disturbing part of the IOM's analysis is that they said very clearly, that we are far from that understanding what is the right care, being able to diffuse it into practice and evaluating the appropriateness of settings. I think that one of the things that is most exciting about comparative effectiveness is that it offers promise to inform delivery in a way that we really haven't had that promise before. Ed did a very good job, and Wilhelmine as well, reflecting that there are a number of very important private sector and indeed public sector activities out there evaluating technology. And by technology, I think we are all referring to drugs, devices, bios, and therapies. So it's a rather broad meaning of the concept technology. But given the stakes now, the where we are on the precipice of change in terms of explosions of new technology, which is a marvelous thing for all of us as healthcare consumers. Now the question is, how do we achieve those IOM objectives, and what, in fact, can be applied strategically and functionally to move us down this continuum? And if many of you are familiar, I know, with the work of Clayton Christensen at Harvard, he's written about disruptive innovation. I think comparative effectiveness could be thought of as disruptive intervention. And the reason I say that, I think it's an apt term, because not only would it fill a gap that needs to be filled, we have a vacuum here of a systematic kind of analysis that would be transparent in the public domain, et cetera. But I do think it should be said that comparative effectiveness and even the discussion around it sets in motion a process that a number of important stakeholders are not sure about the consequences of, and therein creates controversy, uncertainty, and a great deal of discussion with each and every one of you. And I think that that window or prism ought to inform our discussion, not discourage it. And I want to try to come back to that point. So I'd like to discuss three things today. First, from our perspective, why we need comparative effectiveness. Second, what it should do, how it should be structured. And a third, how it should be part or thought of by all of you. Again, I don't mean to be presumptuous in saying this, but I know all of you are struggling with how do we get to a quality agenda nationally, so how can we work together to do that? So I wanted to put that in context a little too. Okay. First, we have a marvelous opportunity in this country to evaluate the wonders of science. We all want innovation. We want to encourage innovation. And the challenge of comparative effectiveness is doing it in a way that preserves innovation, preserves access, but also gets to that right care, right time, right setting. We have tremendous uncertainty now about safety and effectiveness. That's not to say that there aren't marvelous opportunities out there for practitioners, clinicians, and the delivery system to use technology, again, broadly stated. But there's very little of the kind of robust research that is necessary as a practitioner to know what to do under what circumstances. And yes, not simply from a safety perspective, from a quality perspective, but also from a cost perspective. I know that is tremendously controversial. I recognize that the IOM has taken the cost issue off the table. But at a time when each and every one of you and your members, your bosses, are looking very, very specifically at the rising cost of healthcare in the United States, taking cost out of this discussion is equivalent to putting our heads in the sand. And for working families, for purchasers, and for government, we're going to have to figure out a way to confront that issue as well, and I want to make some suggestions about it. Carolyn Clancy talked about the work they've done at ARC in terms of the consistency, setting consistency of methodology. That is key here, that if we're going to have reliable analysis, it has to be consistent. And we also, I wanted to share with you, as you look at the third point, the growing concern, which you hear well in all of your offices daily, about the burden, the cost burden, the care, the cost of care burden on families. One of the major issues that's now working and very exciting in terms of the partnerships that are going on between our community and the provider community is actually evaluating how to assess efficiency. So we are confronting in the payer community with practitioners and clinicians, and a number of them are here today in the context of the AQA, which is an organization that I hope most of you are familiar with. If you're not, it's on the web, aqaalliance.org. We are working with practitioners side by side to evaluate quality and, yes, begin to figure out together, not separately, how to assess efficiency. We have to bring that same discussion to this area, in this arena, and begin to have the same conversations with manufacturers and others. What problems can be addressed? Clearly, I think the gold standard here is trusted source, and that informs how we want to think about establishing comparative effectiveness, and I'll come to that in a moment. There is clearly insufficient information in practitioners' hands, consumers, and purchasers, and we have a difficulty now in hitting that IOM promise of a system that is more effective and efficient than it has been. In terms of how this could be structured, our view is that it should be an independent body. And at the risk of sounding not politically correct, let me give you an example of why. More than 10 years ago, ARC began to develop best practices with respect to lower back pain. It created a tremendous backlash, set of concerns, on the part of practitioners, and there was an effort to defund ARC and, in fact, take ARC away as a result of that activity. This needs to be an independent body insulated from the kind of back-and-forth political discussion. That is not to say that it should be on its own in a vacuum. It needs to have the direct participation of manufacturers, of consumers, of payers, of scientists, and the best and the brightest, frankly. And we need to figure out a nomination process that would garner the individuals that would fit that bill. But that's why we think about, largely based on that experience, we could cite other experiences as well, you need an independent body. But we also need to make sure that it is an independent body of the best and the brightest with a kind of opportunity for advice, consent, and consensus that is necessary for this to move forward in a way that can be acceptable and take account of the concerns of all stakeholders. If we don't develop and begin to think about the problems that could be confronted from the beginning, then we will never directly establish the right structure to hit the mark in the view of the different stakeholders. We see it as public and private, and we see it as having the ability to draw upon the work of ARC, of NIH, of the Institute of Medicine, and a range of other entities that have done very important work also in the private sector. We see it functionally as setting priorities. We do not think the priority setting should be disembodied from this organization. It should set priorities. It should commission studies. It should validate results. And one thing we have learned very definitely in the health plan community as we construct a different way of reimbursing clinicians is that a fundamental principle we found there applies here, that manufacturers, and again, broadly stated, that have drugs, devices, bios being evaluated and sometimes evaluated together across the spectrum. It's not simply going to be drug to drug, bio to bio, bio to device, what have you. It's going to be across the spectrum, and it should be allowed to be across the spectrum. Then it's very important for those entities to have an opportunity to assess the methodology, to provide input, and to validate results. So we think that that's going to be an important feedback. And then this would obviously involve disseminating results to the public and to clinicians, consumers, et cetera. It shouldn't be circumscribed too narrowly. It should be left to the board to look at the full span of activities in terms of the evaluations. It should not be pre-decided about taking certain things off the table. Here I'm not talking about costs. I'm talking about the province of the research. So to look across therapies to drugs, drugs to devices, drugs to bios. The next slide talks about the opportunity to look at the issue of disparities, for example, in some of these studies. how do African Americans with heart disease fare using certain devices, procedures, bios, et cetera. That's one example. Looking at effectiveness and value, and yes, it can, it should not dictate benefit design, but the idea that we would have this robust research and not pay any attention to it, that makes no sense whatsoever in our view. Finally, I think that as you think about a quality agenda, we've enumerated some issues here. I do think that we need a process to set a national research agenda to identify gaps. The IOM talked about that in their report. We think NIH could be particularly helpful here. There needs to be more effort to coordinate the dissemination of clinical best practices. We think ARC could be very helpful here and disseminate that into practice much more quickly than we're doing right now. And we think that there should be a look at the approval of devices and whether or not it is adequate for the future. It works very differently than under at FDA for devices than it does in the area of pharmaceuticals, as many of you know. And we think that given the wonderful opportunities we have now and in the future, that ought to be looked at again. And then finally, there's been a great deal of work done on uniform performance measurement, data aggregation, dissemination. I'd be happy to talk about that if there are questions. And finally, Ed, I know we're running out of time, but just quickly, I know you're all going to roll your eyes about malpractice reform. You're going to say it's too hard. Why is she bringing it up? It doesn't have anything to do with the price of tomatoes. Here's why. If we want to get to best practice, we are talking about sorting through potential opportunities. And if you are a clinician being expected to deliver best practice, and yet the current system provides not only an incentive, but it basically requires you to do everything possible. Those two things are inconsistent. So as you think about a quality agenda, I just wanted to make an argument once again for Congress to look again from the perspective of quality at the issue of malpractice reform. Thank you.
Very interesting. Thank you, Karen. Finally, you're going to hear now from David Nexon, who's the Senior Executive Vice President for Domestic Policy of the Advanced Medical Technology Association, AdvaMed. For more than 20 years before joining AdvaMed, David was the Democratic Health Policy Director for what's now the Senate Help Committee and Senior Health Advisor to Senator Ted Kennedy. It's AdvaMed's members who produce many of the products and technologies that might be subjected to comparative effectiveness analysis. So I guess you could say you've heard from some of the comparers, and it's time to hear from some of the potential comparees. David, thanks for being here.
Good for that introduction, and thanks especially to the the Alliance for Health Reform for putting on this this seminar. It's Alliance for Health Reform for many years has been kind of in the forefront of helping people sort through these policy debates, and this is clearly a very important and timely topic, and I thank you for doing this, Ed. Let me say that speaking both for AdvaMed and as a longtime person interested in public health policy, I'd like to make 5 points very quickly, then go back and talk about a few of them in more depth. But really, it's going to be, because of the time limitations, it's going to be very much hitting the high points, and hope we can follow up on some of this stuff during the discussion. I should also say that we don't have any patient groups on this panel, but based on our discussions, we think that most patient groups probably share the viewpoint that I'm about to express. First, I'd say that I strongly favor more comparative effectiveness research. I think a heightened federal investment in this area is very welcome, overdue, and very useful. Too often when patients and physicians are trying to decide about alternative courses of treatment for a particular disease or condition, they're flying blind. And the more we can do to provide them helpful information, I think the better off our health system will be and the better off individual patients are. And as Carolyn and Karen pointed out, I think dissemination of research findings in some ways is important as doing the research in the first place, because often we do the research, it takes a long time to filter down into clinical practice. Having said that, however, I think there are some cautions about what we do with any new federal entity to conduct comparative effectiveness research. And the second point I'd like to make is that comparative effectiveness should be used to inform clinical decision making. It should not be used to deny coverage for safe and effective treatments. And I'll talk about that a little further, more further in the discussion. There are many reasons for this, but the most important reason is that patients differ. Comparative effectiveness research typically looks at the impact of a treatment on an average patient within a study population. It doesn't take into account patient differences in comorbidities, genetic heritability, race, ethnicity, even income levels that can affect effective treatment. And because it does that, making a blanket coverage denial based on a comparative effectiveness studies, if the two treatments are safe and effective, I think is wrong. It's wrong for patients, it's wrong for doctors, and it's wrong for our healthcare system. The second point I would make is that using comparative effectiveness research is even for cost effectiveness is even more problematic. I don't think it's consistent with American values to say that we're going to give people the cheapest treatment, not the best treatment. We've always resisted that in the Medicare program. We said it's not the right thing for our senior citizens. I don't think we should be pursuing a research course that says that's the right course for our nation in the future. The fourth point I'd like to make is that I don't think comparative effectiveness should be viewed primarily as a cost control tool. I do think that by improving clinical practice, it will have an impact on cost because I think better quality care in the long run ends up to lower costs. But there's no evidence, really, that doing a kind of a technology or a drug-by-drug kind of analysis does anything significant about the long-term cost drivers in our system or really will have a significant effect on our $2 trillion healthcare endeavor. I think there are ways where we can have a much more direct and effective influence on cost. And so I think we ought to think about comparative effectiveness as something that may influence costs over the long run, but it's not really a cost control tool and shouldn't be viewed that way. And finally, just sort of one overarching point, and for this audience, I think it's particularly important to say this. I do think when we look at all health policies, not just comparative effectiveness, one thing that we always ought to be thinking about is their impact on medical progress and on technological innovation. Since in the last 30 or 40 years, we cut the number of people who die of stroke by two-thirds, the death rate from stroke by two-thirds. We've doubled the survival rate from cancer. We've got, in the area of heart disease, we have 1 million people every year who would have died if we treated them by the technologies available in the 1960s, but live because of the medical progress we've made. And we're now entering this era of, the new century of the life sciences, where the fundamental discoveries that we've made in terms of the characteristics of the cell, of proteomics, of genomics, give us the opportunity to really make immense advances, much more than we've done in the last 30 or 40 years. So it's terribly important that as we consider policies, we think about, are we going to retard or slow down what might be otherwise be tremendous advances in public and individual health. Let me now turn to the second issue I raised, that the significant issue, the problems with making non-coverage decisions based on comparative effectiveness. Carolyn pointed out that these studies are rarely kind of definitive slam dunks. Rather, they say, well, once one thing appears to work better in most people, not as well in other people, sometimes, although in most cases they don't do subgroup analysis because of the trouble of powering trials, they're able to distinguish between who it works best in, which is sort of the best information. But they're rarely definitive in the sense of saying that for each patient, we know that this treatment works better than this other treatment. And so you don't want to get in a situation where an insurance company bureaucrat or a government bureaucrat takes away that discretion from patients and physicians to decide what's best for that individual patient sitting in front of them based on the best medical knowledge available. Nobody is average. Everyone is different. And the treatment that works for people on average does not necessarily work for you or your mother or your child when they have a condition that needs to be addressed. There are also significant differences in patient preferences that really are a separate issue from effectiveness. Some people would rather take a course of a more risky surgery that would cure their disease completely. Others would rather have drug therapy, which may not be as effective in curing the disease, but involves lower risk. Those are decisions that should be made by patients and doctors, not by insurance companies or by the Medicare or by the government. There's also a time dimension to these studies. I would take issue with Karen. I think that the new technologies, particularly in the area of devices, are the last places that you ought to be doing comparative effectiveness research, and I'd be happy to expand on that further during the course of the discussion. I think that this comparative effectiveness used to deny coverage can lead to a cheapest is best approach to medicine. And I think that the results, as I say, are rarely conclusive, not only for the individual patient, but even for the average patient. You know, you do one study and then you do another study and it shows something different than the first one did. On the area of cost-effectiveness, cost-effectiveness is an interesting, academically very interesting issue. It's methodologically extremely suspect as a way of doing individual decision-making. I've looked at it in some detail and be happy to discuss it further. But what they try and do a cost-effectiveness analysis is to put a value on a human life and then assess the effectiveness of the treatment in terms of how many quality years of life it generates compared to potentially to another treatment or just in terms of some absolute standards. The value they put on the quality of years of life varies widely depending on the researchers. It's NICE uses a figure of 40,000 to 60,000 generally. In the United States, we typically use 100,000. Some people recently published an article said it should be 132,000. I can tell you right now, first of all, I don't know how you value your life or the life of your child or your parent, but I doubt that you'd want to say, well, if it costs more than $100,000 per quality year of life to give them this treatment, I don't want them to get it just as soon as have them die, number one. And I don't think that's the view most Americans take. Number two, the fact is that developing these numbers is more, you know, black magic than science, and I'd be happy to talk about that further. But beyond the sort of the methodological issues in it, I think it's just the wrong approach for Americans. I don't think that we believe people should be denied life-saving, life-enhancing medical care based on the cost of that treatment. That's why we want to have everyone in the United States have health insurance. It's so that they can get access to the treatment they need, even if they can't afford it individually. Now, the final point I'd like to make is that there are better ways to attack the cost problem than comparative effectiveness research. As I indicated, there's no evidence at all that this kind of approach has a significant impact on costs. But what we do know, and it's really becoming kind of the coin of the realm in political discourse in all the platforms of the presidential candidates, there are some ways that are very promising that allow us potentially to make a very major impact on the cost problems that afflict our country. And we know we have to get a handle on these healthcare costs, as Karen pointed out. The first thing we can do is take a serious look at an important federal intervention and, you know, investment in preemption. The cigarette companies spend about $15 billion annually promoting products that kill people. I don't know what the total budget of the CDC is, but I doubt it's anywhere close to $15 billion. And that's for one product. So we could certainly do a lot more in this regard. Management of chronic care. Our system for managing chronic care in the United States is a disgrace. It's so disorganized, so ineffective, so costly, and so unrewarding for patients. We can do a lot better. And as you know, chronic care is implicated, most of you know, I'm sure, in 80 to 85% of all health care costs. Isn't that a good place to start trying to get a handle on the cost problem? There are other aspects of quality besides chronic care where there are tremendous opportunities to reduce costs while improving the quality of our health care system. We know that medical errors, many of which are avoidable, generate huge costs throughout the system. Hospital-acquired infections are a major cost driver, which can be addressed by better management internally in the hospitals and better use of healthcare technology. Efficiency, our healthcare system is tremendously inefficient. We need to look at things like value-based purchasing to provide some incentives for efficiency, by which I mean both quality and lower cost in delivering care. And the use of information technology offers tremendous potential to bring down the cost of our system. We've got a 19th century healthcare system in terms of the information technology we use has been a tremendous driver of productivity improvement in virtually every other industry in the United States. And finally, innovation itself, that is development of new treatments and cures, to my mind, offers tremendous hope for reducing costs. You know, it's sort of common sense that if you can prevent disease, detect it sooner, cure it quicker and more effectively, you can bring costs down. We have wonderful opportunities to do this given the progress of science. Just a cure, just to delaying the onset of, to take one example, just delaying the onset of Alzheimer's disease for five years and where there's a potential of having a cure within 5 to 10 years with some of the pharmaceuticals coming down the pike, would save us $50 billion a year as a society. And there are many other examples like that. So I've covered a lot of ground. Why don't I stop and leave it open for questions and comments?
Excellent. Thank you, David. Let me remind you, you have green cards you can use to write questions on. There are, excuse me, there are microphones that you can use to ask questions orally, and there are blue evaluation forms as we get through the Q&A that we'd love to have you fill out to make these sessions even better than they are now. If you would identify yourself.
Sure. My name is Kate Sheriff. I'm with the Department of Health and Human Services. And I guess I'm hearing on the panel some differences of opinion about whether comparative effectiveness research is something that we can use to actually save costs in the medical system or whether it's just going to be something that's going to improve the quality of care. Furthermore, it sounds like there's some differences of opinion about whether we should use comparative effectiveness research just to be getting best practices out there and to be informing clinical decisions, or whether it should be used in making payment decisions in some way. And I guess my question is there any research or are there numbers out there that would give us an idea of how much money we could potentially save both in the public sector and in the private sector from either of those ways of using comparative effectiveness research, either just getting the best practices out there or actually using it to inform payment decisions? And I'm sure there's a lot of disagreement about that, but I'd be interested in hearing people's thoughts about kind of the potential for savings from this, if there is any.
Karen? David? Wilhelmine?
Okay. Well, I just would call your attention to late last year, the Congressional Budget Office did do a review of comparative effectiveness activity, and I don't have the numbers at my fingertips, and perhaps Karen or David can fill them in, but they did demonstrate that over several years it would be a cost-saving investment to invest in comparative effectiveness research, both through the avenue that David mentioned, which is higher quality care tends to be perhaps less wasteful and less expensive. But I don't believe the estimates excluded the possibility of it resulting in coverage determinations or payment limits.
Do you want to go first? That's right, and they also issued, I think, a very important report just about a month ago, which supplemented that report you referred to, Wilhelmine, in the sense that they looked at the role of technology as a cost driver, and they found that 50% of the increase can be attributable to technology over a fairly long period. I think this is a very important research. This is very important research that CBO has done. One of the things I wanted to use an example, anticipating a question such as this. We know that the NIH National Eye Institute is conducting a head-to-head trial on two products, both made by Genentech for macular degeneration, and that's age-related macular degeneration. Avastin is one product and Lucentis is the other. Lucentis costs 50 times Avastin. And so that's a very clear indication. It wouldn't mean that a health plan would, assuming they both have similar properties and can effectively perform the same function, doesn't mean that a health plan wouldn't cover them. We might put the more given the analysis, and it hasn't yet been done, so I'm just hypothesizing now, but we might put it in a higher tier, for example. This is the kind of research that is necessary, done by a very objective third party, which is why we're very much interested in comparative effectiveness being done robustly, objectively, and with manufacturer input to make sure that we're getting, as public, as the matter of the public, all the information we need. That's just one example. There are myriad examples that we can go through. So we're not making the point that it should be dispositive. We're making the point that to have a discussion that somehow we should create the best processes possible with the right kind of advice, consent from manufacturers, products, drugs, bios being evaluated, and then not look at it for determinations makes no sense to us.
Can I respond to that?
Well, let me make a couple of points.
past and I've seen that says how much you might potentially save on this was
the
The only estimate I've seen that sort of tries to put a number on how much you might save from this kind of activity, and Karen's right that the CBO didn't distinguish from what savings that might be achieved from improvement in clinical practice and from possible use and coverage decisions of the CBOs. They found a several billion-dollar savings over a 10-year period. It was a drop in the bucket in terms of our overall healthcare system. It's also the case that if you read that report, there isn't any evidence at all on which that estimate is based. So, I mean, you have to take it, as I say, you have to take it with a grain of salt. And I do believe there are some savings to be gained by better clinical practice, but I don't think it's a solution to the cost problem in any, you know, any significant or short-term way. With regard to the issue of whether we should use these findings and coverage decisions, I think that they ought to be used in terms of the processes of care, you know, practice guidelines and that sort of thing. But I still believe very strongly that if treatments are safe and effective, and I emphasize if they're safe and effective, they should be available to patients because there are so many individual variants in patient needs that a single solution isn't clinically right for, in most cases, for all patients. And an insurance company or the government shouldn't be saying that you shouldn't have access to the thing that's clinically best for you. Now, sometimes a comparative effectiveness study or an effective study will, in fact, show that something is not safe and effective. Many products that are used have never passed through FDA's safe and effective screen because they're used off-label. If a study that's a good quality study that's conclusive says that something that's used that FDA has not approved for that purpose is not safe and effective, of course an insurance company should have the ability to deny coverage for it. If we look at procedures which have never passed through an FDA screen, which would be true of surgical or medical procedures, of course the insurance company should rely on good scientific evidence to make a coverage decision. If somehow there's a slam dunk, this almost never happens, and you find out from a subsequent study that the FDA made a mistake in a study that in a product that they thought was safe and effective turned out not to be. Obviously, that should be part of the decision making. But when the products are safe and effective, I do not believe that the research should be allowed to be used to make blanket non-coverage decisions.
By the way, we have some wonderful questions that you've put on cards. We also have a number of people lined up at the microphone. So, with about 20 minutes left for questions, if you have a burning desire to have your question answered, I would advise you to repair to one of the microphones. So with that, please identify yourselves.
Hi, I'm Stu Gutterman at the Commonwealth Fund. And on the issue of how much money might be saved by comparative effectiveness, the Commonwealth Fund actually put out a report in December called Bending the Curve, where we looked at a set of options for improving value in the healthcare sector, and one of the options involved a comparative effectiveness mechanism combined with what we'll call teeth to be able to make sure that people had a strong financial incentive to act on that information when it was produced. And our estimate was that over 10 years, up to $368 billion could be saved by a comparative effectiveness mechanism that had effective policies attached to it to actually inject that information into the decision-making process.
Thank you. Thanks very much. You'll find that report on the Alliance website in the materials for the briefing on that subject that we did, I think, in January, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, go right ahead. Yes, there is someone standing there, but you go ahead and then we'll come to the other side.
Okay, two quick comments. My name is Lisa Summers and I'm with the National Partnership for Women and Families. And the partnership is part of a coalition called the Alliance for Better Healthcare, which includes a number of consumer groups and some of the disease specialty groups. And I just wanted to make the comment that it's certainly my sense that there's a great deal of enthusiasm among the consumer groups for the comparative effectiveness and sort of really wanting to see that move forward with greater transparency, et cetera. And the second comment I wanted to make was in response to Karen's comment about liability reform. I mean, I work for a certainly the progressive community, I think, gets really nervous when people start talking about liability reform, and everybody thinks you're talking immediately about caps and caps on economic damages and tort reform. I come from a background in obstetrics, having practiced in academic health centers for a dozen years, and I think this discussion about comparative effectiveness really underscores the fact that, particularly in the field of obstetrics, you can have all the evidence on your side. Let me tell you, in this day and age, you don't go to court in a brain-damaged baby case unless you think you're going to win it. You can have all the evidence in the world, and you can get a $16 million judgment against you because that's what the jury chooses to do. So I just can't underscore enough the importance, I think, of your comment, particularly in women's health and in obstetrics. We have a real crisis in obstetrics. So I was so glad to hear you say that, and I think that we can look beyond those conversations we've had to injury prevention funds and other sorts of reform to the liability system. So thank you for that.
Thank you. If I may add just a quick comment, I really appreciate you making that point. You guys do great work, and we've partnered with you on a number of things, so we very much appreciate that. And I think that one of the things I didn't say because I was watching that clock in front is I think there can be new models that we haven't talked about. We've done a lot of thinking about this, again, with the physician community since we've been working so closely on the quality arena. And if you're interested, we'd be delighted to come to talk with you about more predictability in the system and more administrative processes versus legal processes, making sure that patients are protected, but at the same time allowing us to move forward in this context of best practice. One other point that I think relates to Stuart's point, I should have remembered the Commonwealth study, and I'm sorry, Stuart, I didn't refer to it. It was very, very good. We in the health plan community were very much involved in 10 years ago in a discussion with many of you about so-called patient protection. And during that time, we were using a number of tools and techniques to do utilization review. We were looking at guidelines, matching practice to guidelines, and there was an almost unanimous backlash from the professional community that they didn't want to be evaluated, and they didn't want to be evaluated by health plans, pretty much the way David has suggested. This might be the next round in terms of comparative effectiveness and how the data might be used. Let me tell you, 10 years from then, now, what's happening. We've re-presented tools, disease management, care coordination, et cetera, and we've taken account of the way the tools were operating. But purchasers are demanding, now public as well as private purchasers, and now consumers purchasing on their own, they want us to look at imaging, which is soaring. The numbers of imaging centers, the numbers of things that are being done in the imaging arena. And there are significant safety as well as cost concerns, and so we're beginning to reintroduce that. We're also reintroducing utilization review in terms of best practices aligned with reimbursement incentives to hit best practice according to clinical specialty societies, not according to health plans. So the idea here is that the health plans don't do the research, which is why we're very interested in a third-party respected source, that this can be subject to public scrutiny, comment, and very transparent. Then when you have the information out there, our responsibility in a very equally transparent way would be to talk to the public about benefits decisions and how we would make them, how we would set them out to try to balance this access to everything that all consumers want with the cost containment that everybody needs and wants as well. These are hard issues. We had a lot of practice in addressing them. And so what we want to do is have a process where we can be as transparent about this issue as we are about now imaging best practice guidelines that are professional society guidelines. And so we will handle this in a very different way than we handled the discussion 10 years ago. So the comments about people with green eye shades or insurance bureaucrats or government bureaucrats, they're very good people. They're chief medical officers making very robust decisions with scientists, with clinicians and physicians, and that's the process we intend to invite, not the processes that were discussed of old.
Let me comment on that. Certainly I didn't mean to impugn in any way the motivations of America's insurance companies. I know I've known Karen for a very long time, respect her, respect the many good people in that industry who are trying to do the right thing. But the fact is, there is a profit motive driving insurance companies. Just there is one driving our companies. And, you know, let me give you just an example of the kind of thing that can go wrong with misuse of comparative effectiveness research. There was recently a well-known study it's well known. It's the Katie trial, which was a study of psychotropic medications for people with severe mental illness, conducted by the NIH. It was a high-quality study. The headline from the study was that the newer, more expensive drugs didn't work any better than the older, less costly ones. Turns out that wasn't really quite true. One of the newer drugs did work better in controlling the mental illness than the other ones did, and it had also undesirable side effects that patients and doctors had to balance. It was also the case that while the new ones on average did not work better than the older ones, that during the course of the 18-month study, two-thirds of the patients changed from one drug to another because they found that the first drug that they were put on didn't work well for them because of their own individual reactions, or the effectiveness kind of wore off over time and they needed to try to do something new. My conclusion from that study is basically all those drugs should have been covered, and perhaps there may have been a practice guideline that says, not, you know, if you had no additional information about the patient, you might try the less expensive drug first. But what happened was that government bureaucrats, that is state Medicaid programs, instituted policies where they had a blanket denial of coverage for all the psychotropic medicines that were newer and more expensive. And that's the kind of thing that this can be misused for. And I think it's a real threat to American medical care and to our own ability as patients to get what's best for us. And by the way, I do not believe that every patient wants everything. I think most American patients want the best care. They don't want everything. They don't want to be subjected to a surgery that's uncomfortable and necessary and be a marginal benefit. But I do think they want the right to determine with their doctor what's best for them based on the best scientific evidence available.
Thanks, David. Karen, let me just clarify something. When you were talking about malpractice reform, the idea is that the best practice knowledge would somehow be incorporated into a safe haven standard of care. Is that the idea?
Yes, exactly, because right now the incentive, and almost if you're practicing medicine today, you really have to do everything possible because you're quite rightly worried about being sued, and that's in direct contradiction with all the work that the IOM and all the other researchers have done about the need for best practice. So it's hard to get there from here without taking account of changing that system as well. But we recognize the controversy there. That's why we've tried to do some new thinking about ways to begin not just the safe harbors, but to protect patients so that patient groups could be assured that if something happened to them, they would be protected in a new system.
Very good. By the way, Lisa Swirsky has sent up to us the CBO analysis on comparative effectiveness from December, I think it is. And there is a section in here that quotes the CBO cost estimate on the comparative effectiveness provisions that were actually passed by the House as part of the CHAMP bill, and I commend that to you. Just make sure that the numbers correspond exactly to the comparative effectiveness parts. Yes, sir.
Merrill Guzner with the Center for Science and the Public Interest. I want to return to the issue of structure. One of the papers in the packet likened the Comparative Effectiveness Agency to a Federal Reserve Board for medicine. And then at the same time, that paper actually called for stakeholder participation in the board and in the design of the trials and or the studies that would take place. My question really to the two stakeholders that are sitting on the panel is your understanding of or is what you're calling for when you talk about transparency, are you talking about having comment and input should there be a clinical effectiveness institute set up somewhere, or are you talking about actually having stakeholder input into the board? And then depending on what your answer is to that, I would just simply point out that the Federal Reserve Board does not have any banks sitting on it when given the functions that it is given to perform. Why should stakeholders with a clear financial interest in the output of this institute be allowed to have direct input into what goes on?
I'm not sure what report you're referring to, but I don't believe it's ours. I don't think that we've recommended a Federal Reserve model. We have recommended a public-private entity that would be independent, and we have thought about a board with stakeholder representation because, in large measure, looking back at where areas of controversy have erupted with respect to moving to improve the science, get our hands around best clinical practice, if folks, particularly manufacturers, particularly others that tend to be very significantly reflected by, affected by results, aren't included from the beginning, we think that that may be a recipe for motivating individuals to, A, not have confidence in the entity, to dismantle the entity, and to repeat the at pass would be prologue. So to avoid that, we've thought about an independent, objective entity with, indeed, stakeholder participation, so manufacturing participation, consumer participation, the best and the brightest researchers there. And, you know, in terms of if people were to ask for recommendations from our community, the type of individual we would recommend would be a chief medical officer that has a significant amount of research experience. So that's the window into our thinking about it.
Participation but not control.
No, of course not control. No, participation, right.
David?
Yeah, I kind of second what Karen said. We actually have not taken a position of public-private versus public, but we do think it should be, however it's organized, there should be representation for all stakeholders for the same reasons that Karen said. And we think in the case of our industry, we have a lot of expertise to contribute about these technologies. We would probably have, as Karen did, our chief medical guys represented, not the, you know, the business guys. We think the process should be transparent with a full opportunity for comment, but we've not taken a position on the location of the agency.
Willamy?
Yeah, I'd just like to go back to what I said in the presentation. While the IOM committee was not asked to give advice on exactly the organizational structure or home of a central program, we did talk at length about the composition of a comparative effectiveness program and who needs to be at the table, particularly on the priority setting advisory committee, the oversight board for a program to structure, fund, and oversee the conduct of comparative effectiveness studies through a hybrid model of local academically based research centers and a central office that would identify the importance of particular topics for review. And what is key in terms of the composition of specific expert panels brought together to determine how to develop a research question for a comparative review analysis and identify the priorities for those analyses as a whole, the need to buffer the recommendations from industry's interests was made very clear in that there would be a prohibition from voting or the decision made about individual studies or topics from anyone who had any kind of direct financial interest in the services at hand. So a great deal of attention was paid to the issue of both balancing panels by bringing in stakeholders that represented industry as well as consumers, as well as practitioners, but also insulating the decisions from direct financial conflict.
Thank you. We have time for one more question, which I believe we have someone to ask. And let me ask you, as this last question is being asked, if you would pull out those blue evaluation forms, start filling them out so that we can figure out how best to improve these programs. And you've got the last word coming.
Great. Thanks, Ed. My name is Emily Holubowicz. I'm with Academy Health and the Alliance for better health care. And our mission each year is to work with appropriators to try to increase the funding for ARC's effective health care program. I can tell you it's a struggle at times in the current fiscal climate. So my question relates to financing, which I think we haven't really talked about on the panel today. You know, for many reasons, obviously, I think most people in this room would agree that comparative effectiveness research is a public good and should be funded federally through appropriations. But the realities of the appropriations process, both given competing priorities and also, as Karen highlighted, the dangers of federal appropriations where an agency or program is vulnerable every year to the whims of appropriators. What are your thoughts on the financing of this? Who should be paying for it? And do you have a sense of how much? And this may be a better question for Stu, but is anyone aware of any studies that have shown the relation of the investment to the return? That is, if we invested more, would we get more back?
I'm happy to. We've done a lot of thinking about this, Emily, and I appreciate the question. The most equitable way to do it, and you'll all groan now because there are no general revenues available for anything, I understand that, but that's the most equitable way to do it because it means that it comes from the public at large. All of us benefit from it. The second way that has been looked at both in the House and the Senate, I believe, is looking at starting the funding with some dedicated funding from the Medicare Trust Fund. There are different models, PROs are reimbursed from the Trust Fund, et cetera. This is, I think, one can make an important quality argument for this, so that's one way. We have indicated that we believe that it should be a broad participation and are comfortable being asked to contribute. And Blue Cross Blue Shield Association has indicated the same thing. However, if you do it strictly on the based on government and then individuals who are directly insured and leave out those who are insured in ERISA plans by employers, I think that you would be leaving out probably about 140 million people. So if we're going to have across the board sharing participation, financial participation, it should indeed be across the board. I think that the House and Senate has tried to walk through this issue very skillfully by thinking about government appropriations to start it, to build it, and then beginning to think about what's next. And I think the only other thing is to look at not a year-to-year appropriation, but to try to look at a five-year appropriation so it truly could be built in the way that I think each of you would want it to be built to anticipate some of the issues that might come before the group and to anticipate the kinds of robust processes that would be necessary to address those issues satisfactorily across the board. So I think there are a number of models, and we are happy to be continuing to be engaged in with each and every one of you about how to do it.
We don't have a formal position on the financing. I just want
to get
for myself,
closer to the mic, Dave.
Sorry. We don't have a formal position on the financing. Speaking for myself, I think it should most appropriately comes out of public money. I don't think you want any private sector gaining undue influence on the thing. And I think public money, you kind of maximize the transparency and accountability of the activity.
Yeah, I would endorse both of those comments. I mean, the IOM committee did make the strong argument that Emily made, which is that this information is a public good that stands to benefit all Americans, and therefore public revenues are the appropriate way to finance it. That isn't a committee recommendation, simply the statement that it is a public good. I guess I'd also say that a long-term appropriation or some consistency and guarantee of ongoing financing would be critical to the sustainability and the quality of the enterprise that that we have outlined in the IOM report. That is, the uncertainty of funding for comparative effectiveness research and its variability is one of the reasons why we don't have as stable and large and robust
a workforce and an infrastructure devoted to this activity. There is a wealth of information out there that needs to be assessed and crystallized that could be done by a program like this, but it will need more sustained resources if that's to happen.
Karen, you have a final word?
I just think Wilhelmine made just such an important point, and I just wanted to put a plug in for 5 years rather than three. It's going to take a while to get this up and running, and if you want to have it at the level, achieving the kinds of expectations you have, I hope you look at 5 years rather than three.
Okay. Well, as you fill out your blue evaluation forms, he said redundantly, I want to apologize to those of you who wrote some very thoughtful questions on question cards that we couldn't get to. It is a multifaceted issue. Karen's comments about the financing reminds me that there are a number of questions about the involvement of Medicare in this issue, either as a payer or a user of information or a generator. I can assure you we're going to return to this issue as we go along. It's a very important part of the dialogue. And in the meantime, I want to thank the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation once again for its support of this forum and for its general interest in this issue as evidenced by its support of the IOM project. I want to thank the Alliance staff. This was a very large and fast-developing program. We're very happy it was popular. We weren't expecting it to be this popular, and it presented some logistical and technical as well as substantive challenges that our staff really rose up to meet. And finally, I want to ask you to join me in thanking our panel for a very, very interesting and useful discussion.